Welcome to a Wired on Development interview. This is episode 3. I've been following Shelley Mannell on Facebook and Twitter for several years now, but it was her wisdom and insight and her knack for finding amazing research that first motivated me to take one of her online courses, and I've been a fan ever since. So naturally, she was the perfect pick for my third interview with leaders in the field of neuromotor development and childhood disability, and she has some incredibly wise words to share. All the links to find Shelley and the things she talks about in the interview will be on the Wired on Development website under the podcast player. And I'll give you some more details about those at the end of the interview as well. Now, I know you'll pick up some brilliant tips from this interview, and because we want you to share them, Shelley and I have decided to offer a chance to win one of her online courses for free. I'll give you those details at the end of the interview. Enjoy. Shelley Mannell, welcome to Wired on Development. Thank you so much for joining me.
It is my absolute pleasure to be here.
So I thought we would start, since we're talking about development, we'll start with your development and where it all started for you.
Okay, well, I'm a graduate of the McMaster Physical Therapy Program many, many years ago. I always knew that I wanted to practice in pediatrics. It was always one of my goals. So in actual fact, I went through a lot of physio school thinking, oh man, I really hope I like the next section because I don't really like this. You know, I went all the way through orthopedics and thought, no, that's not me. But then fortunately, I got to neuro and pediatrics, and that was where I found my niche. I spent a great deal of time sort of volunteering in and around a hospital situation in my teens. And I looked at all the professions and I thought that physiotherapy, out of all of them, seemed to have, for me, the most meaningful contact and building of relationships with patients and clients.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. I was there as well, just doing volunteer work as a student, and I worked with a great physio. That was sort of the beginning for me. I must have been about 14. So you knew right from the beginning, neuro, pediatrics was your thing?
Yeah. I mean, I did some work in adult neuro when you know, sort of towards the end of my school program, and that was great. I was really interested in that, but I was much more drawn to working with all ages of children, and I do think that it's the developmental piece of that, that overlay of not necessarily having built a motor plan and then lost it, but actually having to develop a motor plan and all the implications of that, that was fascinating to me.
Yeah. When did you start actually working in peds after you graduated?
I spent a very brief stint in adult ortho for about 6 months after I graduated, and then I went straight into pediatrics.
Okay. So what was your first job looking like?
Well, my first job was at the local children's center here. So when I got there, it was a little bit of everything. I did some school care when I first arrived. The school care program wasn't that old when I started in it. And so I did some school care, and I did small stint in administration, and I was the director of orthotic clinic. And I worked in the early preschool and kindergarten classrooms, because we still had a school at that point. And I also was a founder of the early intervention team.
Wow. Where did you find your niche about what areas of pediatrics you actually wanted to delve into?
Well, I think that the interest in postural control came early for me. I'm an avid reader, always have been, ever since I was a child. And that piece of the puzzle was always fascinating to me because it really seemed to underlie everything that we did, regardless of what our goals were with clients and families. And I got the opportunity to talk about it quite a bit early on in my career. I don't live far from McMaster University. And early on in my career, I was given the opportunity to be a sort of a center research coordinator for a study group that was conducting some multi-center research around an outcome measure for children with CP. Right. I actually had the opportunity to go to the study group meetings and sit. And of course, I didn't really have very much to say being a young new grad, but I got a lot of listening in. And then I had the opportunity to read some of the research that people were talking about in those research study group meetings. And so that sort of started me on my more of a formal quest, I think, to do some more reading about postural control and how that develops and how to think about that. And then I also got the opportunity to do a little bit of clinical teaching in the School of Physiotherapy at McMaster during those years. And so that began some of my teaching as well.
Okay. It's an amazing place to start your journey, isn't it?
Yeah.
Who were your early influences?
I think one of my formative experiences, I think, was probably doing my 8-week NDT training early in my career. And again, that was an opportunity. We went as a team from the Children's Center when I was working. So we went as OTPT and speech. And we went to Newfoundland and we studied for 8 weeks. So that was an amazing opportunity. And again, the concept of talking about postural control and development in children with cerebral palsy is obviously a cornerstone of NDT treatment. So I think that was sort of an opportunity to again, influence my thinking about how children develop and why they move the way they do. And a couple of years after I finished that training, I started to mentor with an OT instructor in the States, whose name was Reggie Bame. And she was an NDT instructor, but she was also much more than that. And so I spent the better part of a decade mentoring with her.
In the States?
Mm-hmm. She was an early influence. She lived in Milwaukee.
Okay. Were you living in the States then? Or?
No, I was living here in St. Catharines, Ontario.
Okay.
So I used to travel.
Okay. So how did that look like? Would you go over once a month or would you just have like phone conversations? How did that work?
I went over periodically throughout the year. I took courses with her and some workshops. I also accompanied several, after I began my private practice, I accompanied several clients to see her at the clinic, and we worked together over the course of several days. Depending on what was happening that year, it was variable how that looked.
Right. I suppose going between Canada and the States is not such a big deal.
No, it is not such a big deal, and I'm very close to the border here, so it's not a big deal to hop a plane and go down at all.
Okay.
I still do most of my continuing education. The stuff that I don't do online, I do in the United States.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. Okay. You did your NDT, and then have you branched out and gone into other areas?
From a movement perspective, I would say that the NDT still drives a lot of my observation skills. My work with occupational therapists, when we started to see a lot of children who would eventually be diagnosed with autism or on the spectrum, a lot of that collaboration has really led me to broaden my thinking about postural control, not simply from a motor and alignment sense, but from a sensory processing sense as well, and the interconnections between those systems.
Right. So as a physio, how did you develop those skills clinically? Was it reading, just working with other therapists, or did you do courses as well on that?
Yep, I did all of that. You know, it was a learning curve. I had one client in particular who was quite involved motorically, but it really seemed to me that the child had a lot of difficulty even, you know, as they were walking into the clinic. And some days were good and some days were not so good. And some days he'd be very agitated and other days he'd be very calm. And so I started to talk to some of my friends who were OTs about, you know, how did that work and what did that look like? And of course, now we talk about that as a matter of course when we talk about emotional regulation. But that was a new conversation to me 20 years ago. So I did a lot of chatting with the OTs. And of course, I also in the course of mentoring with Reggie in Milwaukee, I met an outstanding OT who has turned out to be one of my closest friends, and her name is Kim Barthel. And Kim teaches a lot about sensory processing. So I've learned a great deal in my reading and my conversations with her. And of course, there's a lot more research now, so that's also fun. To be able to track it. One of the books I picked up earliest was Motor Control by Shamoy Cook and Woollacott. And that started to really shape my thinking and how I looked at postural control and the interconnections. It's still a resource that I go back to. It's one of those ones you can reread 50 times and still learn new things. But pretty much I have to say that that's always been my path.
Mistakes you've learned from as you've gone along?
Oh my gosh. I make a mistake every time I see a child, I think. You know, when you choose something and it doesn't work, that's an opportunity, right? It's always the option to say, what was that that didn't serve that child? What was that that didn't work? And what does that tell me about how they're putting movement together or how they're struggling? So all of those, probably one of my earliest mistakes was just thinking that one approach would work for all of my kids, or one level of intervention. And the more we learn, the more we understand that there are so many layers for our clients, and they interact and interconnect so much that one set of skills just won't do it. We need multiple sets of skills, and you need to be able to choose from that toolbox. And it's a problem-solving process, which tools are going to work best for which children.
Absolutely. Do you have a go-to place where you start when you see a child, or is it very variable?
Oh, absolutely. But my go-to piece, given my latest decade of work, is always what we call the inner core musculature, or the anticipatory core musculature. So I always look at the fine points of alignment between the pelvis and the rib cage, and watch to see what it is that's happening with the child's central stability before they begin moving.
Right. And that's one of the courses that I did of yours, which was fantastic. Great learning, I have to say.
Okay.
Right now, your focus is on the inner core strategy. What sort of researchers or books or clinicians are driving your learning?
Well, I mean, I'm always following the research on core stability and looking at the research in the different pieces of that, whether it's respiratory diaphragm or pelvic floor, or the research that's coming out on postural control in cerebral palsy or autism or developmental coordination disorder, anything that comes out or addresses low tone, because so many of our children have a low tone base, I'm always fascinated with. My reading that's up on my desktop at the moment, in the long list of articles that are still sitting there, is some reading on interoception. So many of our children not only don't have a good body schema or body awareness, but they have poor awareness of how they are feeling. And so I'm searching to learn more about how that information gets processed and where that might provide a challenge for our kids in terms of developing their awareness of moving their body through space. And of course, interoception, as I now understand, happens to be impacted a great deal by the sympathetic and parasympathetic autonomic nervous systems.
Right, which brings you right back to your diaphragm and breathing.
Exactly. It does. You see all these interconnections, you sort of come around in a circle. My other set of reading actually happens to be on trauma at this point in time, because a lot of my clients I am finding have some level of trauma in their history. So again, that leads me to try and understand the impact of trauma on the central nervous system.
You kind of got into teaching quite early on in your career. Where did you get onto with the online courses and doing that sort of thing?
Well, that's fairly recent. I did start teaching, sort of helping out clinically in the physio program at McMaster for about 10 years. But in my role at the Children's Center, we had a position called a clinical resource therapist. So part of my job was to gather resources and clinical options and information for the therapists and to disseminate that, and also to organize in-services. So early on, we started doing a little bit of in-house NDT in-servicing with the team that I trained with, and that just sort of seemed to expand itself. People asked to come. I have to say the online format came at the encouragement and behest of my adult teaching partner, Julie Wiebe, who developed that dynamic core clinical model in adults. And then we put that together and combined it with some of the sensory information to make it applicable to children with motor and sensory challenges. But Julie is much, much more technologically competent than I am.
Okay.
So that's how the online format came to be when we decided to give a live online course, because so many people can't travel these days. It's not an option. And then we recorded it so that we could offer it on demand.
And how have you found it with therapists learning?
We've had some really good feedback. We developed some very specific resources for that online live course that allowed people to really do labs with some direct input with videos and some resources that we specifically developed to help them through that when we weren't going to be there in a live lab. And as I said, our feedback has been positive. Everyone seems to be able to carry those through with the support that we've provided.
Yeah. How much time do you spend teaching as opposed to working clinically with kids?
It varies depending on the year, but generally I teach a course about once a month, and then I am working in the clinic about 4 days a week.
Okay. Good. What would be your recommendations for best books in the field?
Oh, wow. Well, as I said, Shumway, Cook, and Wallacott, that motor control, translating research into clinical practice, is one of my favorites. There was an article written in Physical and Occupational Therapy and Pediatrics, and it was, again, by Westcott and Bertner, and it was called Postural Control in Children, Implications for Pediatric Practice. And again, one of the things that I particularly liked about that article was it gave a way to think more about how one intervenes, not just postural control and development in children with motor and sensory challenges, but actually different layers of intervention and how to think about those layers and how to intervene. Even though that one is a slightly older article now, I think it was 2004, it remains one of my favorite articles. I'm a big proponent of being very knowledgeable about typical development.
Right.
So that we can start to see what is different about the way that our clients move and start to ask ourselves, you know, why are they moving like that? What is it that works for them about moving like that? And what is it that creates a challenge to furthering development and their motor skills when they are moving like that? Of course, Lois Bly's book,
of course.
Motor Skill Acquisition in the First Year of Life. And my other absolute favorite was a book written by Barb Cupps and Reggie Baim and Rona Alexander called The Normal Development of Functional Motor Skills. And again, I particularly like that one because they break it down by age group, but it talks about postural control and then not just gross motor development, but also oral motor and respiration and upper extremity function and fine motor.
Yeah, those are all some great suggestions. If you were to recommend to therapists just getting into the field, what courses would you recommend or where would you suggest they start learning?
Well, you know, that's always a tough one. Pediatrics is huge. I mean, we have We have people working in the NICU. We have people working in the schools. We have people working in orthopedic clinics, seeing kids. So it's really hard to narrow that down. You know, really, really having a hard look at the population that you're seeing. And in the beginning, finding a senior clinician or a mentor in your area. When I first practiced, we were all starting in rehab in children's centers where we had support built in. I remember going out to lots of my first clients and in developmental centers and large preschools and having the staff have, you know, a million and one questions for me. And I always said, I'm not sure about the answer to that, but I'll get back to you. I was a new grad, you know, what did I have off the top of my head? So being able to go back and speak with senior clinicians and learn from their experience. We all know how much we don't get in school. That's really the practical application. So having senior clinicians who are willing to help you, I think is so very important to bridge that gap between what is essentially theoretical learning and then actual clinical practice. So even more so than, you know, finding a course, I think finding someone who can guide you. Now many of our new grads are going out where they have no support. And I think that that must be incredibly challenging as a new grad. And finding somebody who will support you in a formal sense as a mentor or in an informal sense, I think that would be the very best thing. When you're first out in clinical practice, you can be so overwhelmed. Things that you never imagined that you were going to have to do. I can remember being in my second week as a pediatric therapist, and one of the moms rolled the wheelchair in to my gym and said, "It's broken again." And then she turned around and left. And I thought, oh, I'm supposed to be able to fix a wheelchair. I haven't a clue. These are all the practicalities, aren't they, of, you know, practice. So I think finding someone to help guide that process for you is invaluable.
Yeah, that's really good advice. It's interesting the way trends go worldwide, that they're so similar in different countries. When I first graduated, the NDT was the thing to do. Everybody did their BioBath course, and that gave you the foundation. Whereas now, you know, that's not the expected norm.
Right. Things go around and they come around. And many people say, well, I don't have any children with cerebral palsy on my caseload. But I think that one of the most important things that NDT teaches us to do is to analyze movement and really look at how a child moves and ask ourselves why they move that way. In my undergrad in physical therapy, we looked at gait, but we certainly didn't look at, you know, how a child moved or how a baby moved. So then you find yourself on an early intervention team, or you find yourself working with children or younger children, and you're not really sure how to analyze their movement. You're not really sure what typical development looks like if you've never had kids. And so you're not really sure what it is about that movement that is working for that child, but and what it is that's holding them back.
Yeah.
And of course, that leads us back to postural control, because it's often their central stability that is lacking. And so they've developed compensations in order to cope with that.
Just to be a bit of an NDT fan, which I am, but how clever Bertha Bobarth was to bring us all back to the pelvis and the core right in those early days before all the research.
Absolutely. And I mean, you know, she was, it's that whole thing. She based it all off of her clinical observation skills, which were outstanding. Yes. If we had a little bit more of that, sometimes I think that our research might be a little bit more applicable to clinical practice. Sometimes I read the research and I think, wow, I'm not really sure that was a question I needed answered. I know that research is incremental in its answering of questions. It has its own sets of challenges. But sometimes I would love it if our research was a little bit more clinically driven. We've been studying some things for the 30 years that I've been in clinical practice. And so if we could drive it from what clinicians would love to know about, I think we might have a faster knowledge translation from research to clinical practice.
So have you considered doing research yourself?
I have not. I love to read other people's research, but in the heart of my soul, I am really a clinician.
Right.
I will help anybody out. I'll gather data. I'll do anything, but I do not wish to be the person who conducts research. And I certainly do not wish to be the person who writes about the research. I have found that I do not love to write, to do research writing.
Right.
I have great fun writing my blogs, and I enjoy that, but not research writing.
Okay, that's a pity, because I think you would add a lot to the field. So, Shelley, I think I'll just jump into some of the questions that we had coming through for you, if that's okay. Shall I read them out to you, and then you can just have a go at answering them?
Sure.
The first one is, can you please address W sitting and techniques you use to encourage sitting positions with better alignment?
Again, I think that... This is going to be, I'm going to start off my answer to all the clinical questions, is asking why it is that a child W sits.
Right.
We understand that they W sit in order to widen their base of support, which leads us to understand that they have less central stability than is ideal. So then we need to look at how their central stability develops, what their alignment is, how that's impacting that respiratory diaphragm and pelvic floor piston, and what it is that we can do in order to promote the development of that central stability. And in the meantime, then you have to have a conversation with yourself as a clinician and with families about alternate sitting positions for that child that will provide them with the central stability that they need in order to free up their arms, which is why they do it. They're freeing up those upper extremities so that they can play with toys and learn about the world. So we have to make sure that we offer them alternate sitting positions that are as equally as stable so that they can continue that learning and we don't impede their cognitive processes.
So what alternate positions do you suggest?
I often look at sitting on a wedge, sitting on a block, to lift them up off the surface if they have that much control.
Right.
And alternately then we'll look at, sort of some small adaptive positioning. Mm-hmm. If it's a floor sitter or something like that, or even at a table. Sometimes it's also a matter of encouraging that child to use kneeling instead of W sitting. Mm-hmm. But again, that's a clinical judgment because kneeling decreases the base of support.
Yeah.
So sometimes that works for children and sometimes it doesn't.
So do you allow W sitting while you're working on other strategies or putting other competencies in place?
I do. In a limited sense, I think one of the things that I try not to do is make parents in particular feel like they have to be running around behind their kids, changing their W sitting every moment of every day. That's an incredible amount of pressure on parents.
Right.
So what I try to do is somehow strike a balance. If they're a child who's crawling around the floor and constantly coming in and out of that position, then I worry a little bit less as I'm working towards changing that than I do if it's a child who sort of pops themselves in that position and then doesn't like to move.
Right.
Trying to strike a balance is always a clinical challenge.
And sometimes it can take quite a long time to develop those other strategies that they need. I've had kids 2 to 3 years down the line with diabetic cerebral palsy that start off W sitting, and as they develop better core, they start to choose better positions on their own.
Yeah, that's the ideal, isn't it?
Right. So next question. Can you please comment on proper scapulae and rib position that must be available before a kiddo should try swinging on a trapeze or traversing the monkey bars?
Oh, those overhead skills. Wow. Yeah. When you put your arms overhead and they're hanging from those monkey bars, unless they're super strong, there is going to be a little bit of a change in the pitch of the rib cage in terms of an upward pitch of those ribs. But what I particularly look for is the child's ability to continue stabilizing the scapula on the rib cage. So if I have a child who then hangs on the monkey bars and those scapula fly out into abduction and don't seem to be sitting on the rib cage at all, then that's a challenge. They need to be able to activate and get some good stabilization in midline of the scapula on the rib cage before we're going to go ahead and let the body weight hang off of those joints.
So can you give some ideas of things you might start with before you get to that point where they're able to hang independently off the bars?
Well, again, they have to have an adequate central stability in higher level gross motor activity. So it's really difficult to stabilize the scapula on the rib cage if the rib cage floats up in an upward pitch or a downward pitch if you want. So when the child is doing even 4-point activities, looking at how they are creating that central stability piece and the alignment of the rib cage in relationship to the pelvis. Those are sort of precursor skills. Weight bearing is hard, which is good because kids need to work in weight bearing if they're going to hope to be able to support their body weight with their feet off the ground. Again, higher level activities, but also, again, being able to control and create some good quality central stability in balance activities, in unilateral stance activities, in running activities, looking at lots of climbing, which unfortunately is something that our kids don't get to do a lot these days. Nobody lets them climb trees or climb fences or you know, we got a good, so if you can find a, I say to parents, if you can find a climbing wall somewhere and, you know, all the therapists, PTs and pediatric PTs and OTs, we're always the ones who get into trouble by saying, let the kids climb up the slide. Right? It's kind of like, okay, well, don't do it at recess, but we can do it at another time. So doing those sorts of preparatory activities, making sure that they can do them with good quality central stability, making sure that they're not struggling with those activities for them to be able to then do upper extremity activities in terms of monkey bars and hanging off the trapeze.
Next question. When working with a pre-walker with spastic diaplegia, what kind of balance works best between strengthening hips, belly and back, gait mechanics, sensory input, and upright balance activities? Shall I read that again?
Yes. Oh. Yes to all of it is my answer. Those children need all of those pieces. When we talk about strengthening hips, back and belly, that's the second, that's the superficial layer of core or central stability. But we've got to go deeper than that. We have to look at the deep layer of central stability. We have to look at how the respiratory diaphragm and the pelvic floor and the TA are creating anticipatory postural control. They're creating central stability before we move. And so a lot of what we see as difficulties with movement is the fact that they are compensating for that lack of central stability. So we need to go all the way back to how that inner core is functioning, what their rib cage and pelvis alignment is and the relationship between those two in static positions, but also when they're moving, and understand at a deeper level how they are creating and why they are creating the movement that they have. Sometimes it's, you know, it's musculoskeletal and joint restrictions. And then sometimes it's how they're organizing from a neuromuscular standpoint and recruiting. So we need to go and address all of those pieces. But again, lots of pieces of gait mechanics have to do with how that child organizes in order to try and shift their weight. And you follow that all the way back to the difficulties that they're having with central stability.
So how do you weave that all together in a session? Do you start with one element and get that right and then move on to the next? Or are you combining the sensory, the inner core, all of that together?
I think you have to be able to dance back and forth between the strategies. Treatment is not a linear process for most of our children. It really isn't. They, at any given moment in time, they need a motor strategy, or they need a sensory strategy, or they need a motor strategy that incorporates the sensory strategy. There are, you know, a million different things that you can do. And therapists are pretty creative. I love that about pediatric therapists, is that they can take an idea and just run with it.
Yeah.
But our kids need us to be able to dance back and forth so that they get what they need in that moment. They're able to put movement together in a more coordinated fashion and more efficient fashion. And then they need to be able to repeat that so that they can learn it and own it.
Perfect. This next question is a good one because we haven't talked a lot about the vestibular system. So is aversion to car rides in childhood connected to predisposition to vestibular problems in adulthood?
I think my answer is it could be. Car sickness is hypothesized to be a visual vestibular mismatch. So your visual system tells you you're moving because there's a moving visual array outside your car window, but your vestibular system doesn't necessarily register that you're moving because you're sitting in a car. So that's, it's hypothesized to be a mismatch of that. There are so many reasons for vertigo in adulthood. There are lots and lots of possibilities. So I think my answer is it could be an issue about sensory sensitivity, either hypo or hypersensitivity, and a mismatch in that visual vestibular connection. And that could lead to vertigo in adulthood, but it also could be something else in adulthood.
Right. So we haven't really touched on good resources for understanding the vestibular system and how to impact it. Maybe it's a good time to just quickly touch on that now.
Well, there are things to be learned from reading the sensory integration information on vestibular function. And there are also things to be learned in the pediatric vestibular rehab literature and online courses, because both of those schools of thought talk about and look at assessing the vestibular system in a slightly different fashion. But for our kids, there are pieces that complement that for them. It's a central processing problem. So I do look at balance, post-rotary nystagmus testing. If the child is old enough, I do use some tests from pediatric vestibular rehab, looking at the subjective visual vertical, but it depends on the age of the child. Because the vestibular system has a connection to almost every single other part of the brain, it's a bit of a powerhouse. We can look at other sensory sensitivities or other sensory modulation difficulties or emotional regulation challenges as being influenced by a vestibular system that isn't working 100% efficiently. So all of those pieces go into my thinking. And there are some basic books on sensory integration. Building Bridges is a nice start of a book. Rosemary Ryan teaches a great pediatric vestibular course. And I think she offers that online as well as in person. I learned a great deal about the visual system and the vestibular system, again, from my friend Kim Bartel, who teaches a course called Seeing and Moving.
Brilliant. That is all really useful. Thank you. The next question is, any chance you would consider coming to New Zealand to present?
I would love to. I came to New Zealand many years ago. It remains one of my favorite places in the whole world.
Where did you visit?
We went from Auckland down, and we traveled down to the northern tip of the South Island.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. Do you organize your own courses, or do you work with somebody to do that? How does that work?
I usually work with a sponsoring agency who's interested in a particular course.
Right.
And then we go from there. Two, 3 years ago, Julie and I traveled to Oman.
Wow.
At Christmas time to teach dynamic core across the lifespan. And that was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. It was very interesting. We were there for 3 days, and we spent 2 days traveling.
I'd like to know more about that. But let's go through the questions because we're running out of time. So the last question is, what's your take on primitive reflexes? Do you see them as a symptom or a cause of neuromotor dysfunction?
Ah, very good. Well, you know, primitive reflexes have come and gone in their popularity over the years. I can remember taking my NDT course and talking a great deal about primitive reflexes, and we had to know all of them. We had to know what they were and what triggered them and what they looked like. And then we sort of stopped talking about
it.
For a longest time, we didn't talk about primitive reflexes. In actual fact, the people who kept talking about primitive reflexes were people in children with learning disabilities. Mm-hmm. That community talks a great deal about primitive reflexes. And I think, again, our understanding of postural control has grown so dramatically in this last 10 or 15 years that what we understand about primitive reflexes has also expanded. Primitive reflexes are there for a reason. They're our early layer of postural control. They help us cope and organize against gravity when we're born, and cope in those first months. But what we also understand is that those primitive reflexes, you know, we used to say that they disappeared. Well, they don't disappear. We know that. I'm certainly a great example of that. If you put me on skis and send me down the bunny hill, you'll see an ATNR about halfway down. I'm holding my breath and I'm holding on for dear life. So we always have them. They're like a default program. And so my answer is that they really get built in and blended into more mature postural control. They provide that early sensory motor wiring for our central nervous system to build on. But at some point, they become not as efficient as we develop more complex movement patterns. And so they are incorporated into the next and the following pieces of our postural control in terms of writing reactions and equilibrium reactions, and then anticipatory and reactive postural adjustments being the final part of mature postural control. What they are really, when we look at children either with low tone or children who have cerebral palsy or higher tone, is they are a way that child is organizing in the absence of efficient central stability and efficient postural control. So they get stuck in using that because that's what's available to them. And then again, I go back and say, but if they don't have efficient central stability, well, we know how to address that now. We understand much more about the deep to superficial recruitment of the core layers and the muscles and how to promote that. So that's what we should be addressing first, and then watching to see what happens with those primitive reflexes.
So there's a lot of quite clever people, I think, who are promoting exercises and activities that are specifically aimed at integrating primitive reflexes. What do you think about those?
Again, I would have a conversation. It's not that I don't incorporate some of those if I think it's necessary in my treatment, but my understanding of the primitive reflexes comes from that in-depth understanding of the development of postural control and the development of central stability. So one of the pieces that has been leveled at a great number of our treatment approaches, whether or not it's NDT or sensory integration or primitive reflex integration, is the fact that our results seem to be hit and miss. And some children improve and some children don't, or it takes a long time to see improvement. And I think that part of the piece that we've missed in all of those is that we have not fully understood the alignment that is required to promote mature postural control.
Right.
And because mature postural control is characterized by the anticipatory component, right? Primitive reflexes, head writing reactions, trunk writing reactions, equilibrium reactions, those are all reacting to perturbations. The only piece that characterizes mature postural control, one of the important pieces, is that anticipatory component. And we now understand that there's an alignment that allows us to recruit that anticipatory core. And we need to start to incorporate that into our treatments and be look at our kids in a more in-depth fashion.
Perfect. That's a great answer. Thank you very much. So just a couple of quick questions because our time is pretty much up. Would you like to talk about anything that frustrates you about current beliefs and practices?
I don't know that I get frustrated. I mean, I get frustrated with myself, particularly if I think about, I reflect on a treatment session and I always think that I could have done better than I did. I could have made a better use of that session or helped that child more. I think that one of the most important pieces that gets missed in practice, and this is all practice, but certainly in clinical practice in pediatrics, is the time to reflect. I learned a series of questions many, many years ago, and I have continued to use those almost automatically now. At the end of the day, of course, I'm in private practice, so I have the luxury to sit for 10 or 15 minutes and think about my sessions that day and reflect on what went well and what didn't go well and what I think is happening with that child and how they're organizing movement and where we need to go next. My progress notes, you know, are almost for many times they're reflective in nature in terms of helping me to formulate where we're going next, but also the opportunity to reflect on what went well for me in that session and was there a set of skills that I thought I was missing in order to help that child in a better fashion. Things that challenged me in that session personally. Those reflective types of questions, I think, are the pieces that help us move forward as clinicians rather than thinking about, you know, we need to do that too, but thinking about, you know, what exercises I need to do with this child or what fun activity can I have for this child. The reflection pieces are the pieces that I think that help us move towards mastery and towards being a more expert clinician.
So do you have those questions as sort of a, not necessarily physical bullet point, but bullet pointed in your head that you go through systematically, or is it more just a general reflection?
No, well, I used to go through them systematically. I suppose if I think back now, I think I probably do go back to them systematically in my head, but it's fast now because I've been using them for 20 or 25 years. And so they form the framework of what I think about when I engage in that reflection at the end of the day.
And where did they come from?
They came from Reggie. Oh, okay. From my time mentoring with her. She used to have us do, we used to do clinical intensives. And so she used to have us fill out those sets of questions after every one of our clinical interventions. So we used to physically actually write them down.
So do you want to roll them off for us?
I certainly can. They were, as I said, they were her questions that helped direct our learning. So the first one was, what was our functional focus for the session? What was the session goal? What new component or skill did the child experience in that session? What did they own? And what prevented the child from establishing a greater function? And what's the next step for the child? And then the ones about reflecting on my skills. What new skill did you learn in the session? What challenged you in the session? And what information or treatment skill do you need to feel greater confidence with your treatment?
Those are fantastic questions. Thank you for sharing those with us. I think that almost answers my last question, but I'm going to ask it anyway, just in case you have something else to add. So what's your best advice for therapists who want to develop excellence in the field of neuromotor development and childhood disability?
Yeah, again, I think that I would encourage therapists to reflect on what it is that you want and how it is that you get there. I don't think that there's one path for any of us. I think that there are multiple roads to get where we're going. But that process of reflection for you personally as a therapist is going to help guide you to where it is you want to go and how it is you're going to get there.
That is awesome. Thank you very much, Shelley. That has been some great advice.
It's my pleasure to have been here today.
Thank you. I hope you enjoyed this interview. If you would like the chance to win a free online course with Shelley for a more in-depth understanding of how sensory processing, self-regulation, and postural control impact development and how to address them effectively with practical treatment strategies, all you have to do is share the link to this interview on Facebook. Tag a friend or colleague and tell them something about the interview that was helpful or interesting to you. And make sure you also tag or mention Wired on Development in your post so I get to see it and can enter you into the draw. So share the link, tag a friend, tell them something interesting or new from the interview, tag Wired on Development. Remember, you can find Shelley on her website at heartspacept.com. That's heartspacept.com. Or on Twitter and Facebook at Heartspace PT, or you can check out her YouTube channel under Shelley Mannell, SHELLEY MANNELL. And don't forget, those links will be up on the Wired on Development website for you. Thanks for listening.